I don't want to live in a country where no one ever says anything that offends anyone. That's why we have Canada.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Is there such a thing as too much tolerance?
How could there possibly be such a thing as too much tolerance?
Do I really have to tolerate opinions that deprive me of my rights?
The irony is that they were so tolerant, they were tolerating intolerance. That's certainly an
example. That's so interesting. So tolerant, you're tolerating prejudice.
'Cause each time I feel it slip away, just makes me want to cry. What's so fun about peace, love, and understanding?
You refuse to bake me a wedding cake. I kick you out of my restaurant. Is this the world we want to live in?
Our guest is Regina Arena from York University.
Late show tolerance tips. Tip number one, stop being paranoid jerks.
The limits of tolerance.
Well, that's it for the late show tolerance tips.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, fellow philosopher, just taking a moment to thank you for being a listener.
And asking you to please consider making an end-of-year gift to support the program, so that we can continue to question everything.
This past year, it's been everything from reference to robots, from math to masculinity.
So head on over to our website, philosophytalk.org, and click the Support Us button at the top of the page.
Or give the gift of thought to the other philosopher in your life with a subscription to our library of more than 500 episodes.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk.
What should you do in the face of radical disagreement?
Do you live and let live, or try to convince the other person they're wrong?
Aren't some ideas just too terrible to tolerate?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ken and I teach philosophy.
And Ray, welcome back to the host chair. It's been a while. Glad to have you on board.
Ah, thanks.
Today, we're thinking about tolerance and radical disagreement. What happens when your moral and political ideals put you deeply at odds with my moral and political ideas?
Well, we agree to disagree. You like Katy Perry, I like Taylor Swift. What's the problem?
Well, Ray, that might work for, like, ice cream or something. I'm not going to get bent out of shape because your tastes differ from mine. But I'm thinking about serious moral issues. I mean, what if one person thinks, for example, that abortion is a fundamental human right, and the other thinks that abortion is just outright murder?
Well, yeah, I think even with something as morally and politically divisive as abortion, we should still live and let live.
Sounds nice, Ray, but have you tried telling that to, like, those pro-lifers marching in the streets or even to pro-choice people? I mean, let's see how far you get with that with either side.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying they have to like each other. The sides just have to tolerate each other.
Okay, I like that word, tolerance. That's a nice buzzword. But tell me, what exactly do you mean by that?
I mean that even if I completely disagree with your views, even if I regard you as benighted for holding them, still I can express your right to hold, express, and to some extent act on them.
Well, that sounds a little, like, begrudging, don't you think? I mean, it's like you're saying to me, okay, Ken, everything you believe is stupid or immoral, and you're stupid and immoral for believing it, but hey, I accept your right to be stupid and immoral if that's what floats your boat.
Yeah.
Gee, thanks, Ray.
What more do you want?
Well, I don't know. I mean, how about a little, like, positive affirmation? How about a little respect?
Come on. It seems like a lot to ask. Why should everyone have to affirm you?
Well, it's not just about me, Ray. It's a fundamental human need, this need for respect and affirmation. And, geez, how would you feel if, like, your partner barely tolerated you?
Oh, yeah, I'd hate that. But that's about my life partner. I don't want to be intimate with most of my fellow citizens.
Oh, like, good, good.
It's all I can do to put up with them.
Gee, Ray, you got a dim view of your fellow human beings, I think.
Yeah, now that you mention it, I guess I do. All those religious fundamentalists shoving their beliefs down my throat, and anti-vaxxers spreading disease, and climate deniers destroying the planet? Ugh, some of those views aren't just wrong, they're downright dangerous.
Frustrating, isn't it, Ray? I mean, don't you wish you could talk some sense into all those awful people?
Fat chance of that. They're not going to listen to me.
Well, okay, maybe they won't. Maybe they won't listen to a philosopher and all that. But don't you think, come on, in your heart of hearts, don't you think the world would be a much better place if just more people were willing to listen?
Yeah, of course. I want more people to listen to me.
Well, then you have to listen to other people, Ray. You have to listen to those vaxxers and fundamentalists. That's only fair.
But I'm right and they're wrong.
Oh, come on, Ray. Now you're just being dogmatic. How do you know they're wrong if you won't even hear them out?
Yeah, seriously, Ken, though, what about flat earthers or Holocaust deniers or homophobes who want to put people through conversion therapy? Sometimes an idea is just so ignorant and so morally bankrupt that it's not even worth considering.
Well, maybe. I mean, especially if the view is, like, so clearly, objectively, morally bankrupt that any person could see it. But, you know, Ray, you can't dismiss every view that disturbs you. I mean, you can't mistake your own deep abhorrence and disturbance at a view for, like, the moral truth.
Yeah, but how do you tell the difference between views that are outside the bounds of reasonable debate and views that deserve a fair hearing, even when you find them deeply disturbing?
Well, that's an excellent question. And to help us think about that excellent question, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Nena Genzer-Debs, to learn more about camps that try to instruct kids in empathy and understanding and to demonstrate to them the limits of tolerance. She files this report.
Reporter Karen DeSaw's kids are grown now, but when they were teens, they, like 10,000 other kids from the Bay Area, attended a several-day retreat that aims to teach high schoolers empathy and leadership skills. Here's a recent promo video for one of these types of camps.
Camp Anytown has taught me that knowledge is power, and if I utilize my voice, I can make a difference in the world, no matter how big or small.
I learned that as long as we stand together, we can accomplish so much more.
A few summers ago, many years after attending as a camper, Karen's daughter was asked to come back to camp, this time as a counselor. Karen is an investigative reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. When her daughter came home afterwards, she was concerned by what she had seen. And so Karen started to ask some questions.
Then I talked to some teachers, and they had some really, really deep concerns about what had gone on. And they were, in one instance, actually kind of horrified.
During her reporting, Karen ended up visiting two different camps, Camp Diversity and Camp Everytown in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And what she found disturbed her. Kids were divided up by identifying factors like race, ethnicity, disability, gender, and asked to speak about and role play stereotypes.
They really try to take the students who are between 14 and 18 into really, really raw emotional places around issues of racial prejudice, discrimination, sexual harassment, abuse, suicide. It gets very intense very quickly and often in very unsuspecting ways.
Terrorists, they're all terrorists. Put that in big letters, terrorists.
Are you Jews waiting for the train or what?
The Mexican Brown group will clean up because they're good at it.
This is from video footage that Chronicle photojournalist Gabrielle Lurie took of Richard Valenzuela engaging in a lunchtime segregation exercise. He was the director at Camp Diversity at the time. And during exercises, Valenzuela would taunt students.
I instigate some areas for them to be able to reveal and to learn because the kids then, you know, can deal with it or have to deal with it. We're hoping that they become less vulnerable.
The basis for Camp Everytown's programming is an idea called contact theory, or contact hypothesis. The most commonly understood version of this idea comes from a book called The Nature of Prejudice, written in 1954 by social psychologist Gordon Allport. He compiled a couple of decades of research and said that under appropriate conditions, interpersonal contact could be one of the best ways to reduce prejudice between majority and minority groups. But Karen emphasized to me that the camp's practices are not rooted in any evidence-based research on effective empathy building. And when she was reporting this story and considering the well-intentioned goals of the camp, she kept a post-it on her computer that said, "At what cost?"
For a lot of the white students, there were real eye-opening experiences. They didn't really get kind of the depth of the pain of discrimination. But it kind of came at the expense of those students who had suffered the discrimination, but also kind of opened them up for the problem of kind of limited aftercare.
Karen says the kids would sometimes share experiences like sexual abuse or even thoughts of suicide, revisiting really traumatic moments. But there weren't mental health professionals present or resources in place to help the campers continue to process and heal after sharing.
Within that 4 days, I probably cut a lot more than I would have within 2 weeks.
That's Carmel Evans. She's a high schooler who attended Camp Everytown in Boulder Creek in the fall of 2017. She suffered from depression before the camp and said that while her experience was amazing, she loved the intimacy and closeness that the camp fosters. She also found it really difficult.
I felt like maybe they needed to talk about coping skills because they made us feel these intense emotions, and then they were kind of like, okay, circle up time to be cheery and happy. But what do you do when you can't pull yourself out of it?
Executive Director Twin Fayak of Silicon Valley Faces, the organization that runs Camp Everytown, wrote a statement that addressed the Chronicle's reporting. She challenged some of the representations, but also announced that they invited various experts to camp to provide feedback. In response, Camp Everytown is instituting changes in training and curriculum that prioritize self-care and trauma-informed practices and partnerships with other youth services.
We all want to see kids come together. It's kind of a hard thing to challenge because if you critique the way they're going about this, it sounds like you don't care about those goals, even if you do.
Pushing these teens to or even beyond their limits might help encourage some towards more tolerance and empathy, but for others, it may do more harm than good. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Nina Gensler-Debs.
Thanks for that bracing report on how challenging it is to get this right. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today, we're thinking about tolerance and radical disagreement.
We're joined now by Regina Rini, professor of philosophy at York University and also the author of Abortion, Ultrasound, and Moral Persuasion. Gina, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So, Gina, this is a great and interesting topic. I wonder, though, what you're an academic, you're a philosopher. What got you interested in questions about moral disagreement and the limits of tolerance and all that? Did you have some, like, upfront experience with deep disagreement?
Absolutely. So a lot of this comes out of my experience living in different moral communities among different types of people and seeing how they think about each other. So I grew up in the Midwest in a politically conservative, a religious family. When I was a kid, my dad would always have a conservative talk radio in the car, like Rush Limbaugh, that sort. And a lot of what I heard was a kind of demonizing of people on the left. And then when I was older, I moved to the East Coast. I lived in New York City for 10 years, and the people I was around tended to be on the left, tended to be liberals. And then I would hear from them a similar sort of, basically the same thing, demonizing people on the political right. And the cards on the table here, my own sensitivities, my own sensibilities politically are more to the left these days. But even around other people who are to the left, hearing them speak that way, dismissively and demonizing the people on the right, still sits with me uncomfortably in the same way hearing Rush Limbaugh attack people on the left did when I was a kid. And so it's that sensation that something's gone really wrong if mm-hmm. our response to hearing that people disagree is to immediately go to they're terrible and no one should ever engage with them.
So some people believe that the best kind of response to moral disagreement like that is this wishy-washy, let's agree to disagree kind of tolerance. Do you think that's the best we can hope for?
No, I don't. And the reason for that is I think that there's something valuable about the way people can relate to each other. And once we appreciate that valuable thing, we see we need to go farther than that. We need to positively engage. In fact, what I argue is that we have a moral obligation to make ourselves open to being persuaded by the people we don't agree with.
So
you can't just ignore them.
Gina, yeah. I think that's a powerful thought. I want to get onto it. I want to probe your reasons for thinking that. But I don't want to give up too quickly. I don't want to surrender too quickly the importance, even though I was kind of arguing against that, this live and let live, I begrudge mm-hmm. you, but okay, you have your stupid immoral views, but we're going to coexist. Kant called that kind of thing what he called unsociable sociability. I mean, we don't really intrinsically like love all of our fellow human beings, but we have to put up with them. And this begrudging mm-hmm. tolerance is like part of, I mean, you got to agree that if we don't have that, we're in deep trouble. Maybe that's not sufficient, but surely it's necessary that we have at least a kind of begrudging tolerance of one another.
Yeah, that seems right to me. I mean, at minimum, if we're going to live together in the same place, we have to at least have that level of begrudging tolerance, like you said. But I think there's valuable reason to want more. And in fact, that I think we're obligated to want more, to seek out more than that.
So can you tell us a little bit more about what the more is that we should be seeking out?
Sure. Yeah, so the idea here is that there's different ways we can relate to people we disagree with. One is to ignore them, like you already mentioned. Another is to threaten them. Another is to try to bribe them. Like, there are lots of different ways we can try to get them to do what we want them to do. But another category is to persuade them, which is to offer them reasons. And I want to pay attention to what's involved in offering somebody reasons. It's saying to somebody, I want you to act differently, believe differently, and I want you to do that because of the reasons I'm about to give you, because you feel threatened.
I think you mean a certain kind of reason, but we'll get into that, because I can give you a reason by pointing a gun at you, but that's not
right,
what you mean.
Right, yeah, exactly.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about radical disagreement and the limits of tolerance with Regina Rini from York University.
How demanding is my obligation to listen to moral persuasion? What if someone's views deny my personhood? Aren't some points of view just so awful that I shouldn't even consider them?
Persuasion, openness, and the limits of tolerance, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. If I radically disagree with you, should I tolerate you, shun you, or try to convince you? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about the limits of tolerance. Our guest is Regina Rini from York University.
Gina, now, I'm not sure I agree with you. You said that we have a duty to be open to moral persuasion from people who radically disagree with it. I think we have a duty of tolerance at least, but maybe more. But even if I were to grant you that we have this duty, aren't there limits to that kind of duty? I mean, aren't there times when you're so beyond the pale that I'm just allowed to shut my ears to moral persuasion coming at me from that direction?
Yeah, I think there are, but they're pretty limited. They happen sometimes, but they're very special circumstances. So the idea is something like this. The reason why we should be open to persuasion is because persuasion is about respect, mutual respect. It's how we show that we treat each other as people whose minds matter and not just as things to manipulate or votes to pay for or in some dismissive way. We really care that everybody's got a mind, everybody's got thoughts. And so being open to persuasion is a way of showing respect to somebody, respecting their mind.
Yeah, that's nice... Go ahead.
Yeah, well, here's the idea. So the thought is that if somebody, the thing they want to persuade you of is that they don't respect you because they regard you as less than human or as not deserving basic civil or political rights, then they're not engaged in a project of mutual respect. They're not trying to share respect back and forth with you. And those are the special circumstances where I think we have no responsibility at all to listen to that sort of person.
I don't know. I mean, I see the claim. I mean, it's a complicated claim with many parts.
Yeah.
But I want to start with the first part. I mean, I do agree that there are persons with whom I'm engaged in a project of, like, collective life together. But there are other persons from whom I, even if they don't treat me as a thing, I'm fundamentally at odds with them. They've got a comprehensive religious doctrine, like, that maybe it doesn't offend me as such, but I still find it deeply morally problematic. I don't know. I'm just going to say, for argument's sake, the Mormons. I don't care what they think about me, but I don't share any kind of community with them that would allow me to reason back and forth with them. So why should I listen to the Mormons?
Because I think you want them to listen to you. I think you do care.
Do I care? You go your way, I go my way. I will tolerate them, but I will not engage them. What's wrong with that attitude?
Because I think that most of us, I think all of us actually, once we're honest about it, want other people to think about us in this way. We want to be respected by others in this way. We don't want them just to see us as a vote to manipulate or someone to step around. We do care that other people see us as having legitimate views, as having views that are actually worth listening to, and that we're not just causal objects, that we're people who have beliefs and thoughts and reasons behind them. And the thought here is, if you want other people to see you that way, then you need to make the effort to see them that way, whether or not that's your instinct.
So I like this as an ideal. I'm worried about how reachable it is and sort of the trust involved in trying to get somebody to see me as a person to listen to. So, like, what if I extend them that trust and they don't extend it back to me?
Yeah, I think that's the right question to ask, and that's really hard. And I think a lot of it depends on the details. I mean, is the reason they're not doing that because they're distracted right now, or because there's other people around pressuring them? Or is it really, if you can really tell they're just never going to listen to you or even see you as a person who could give them reasons, then I think that we get close there to the special circumstances I mentioned, where given that you can't share reciprocal respect to that person, your obligation to listen to them seems to fade too. But I want us to be super careful that we're not just preemptively dismissing the people we disagree with and assuming they never could listen to us.
I want to go back to your fundamental thing that I want all people to listen to me and therefore should listen to all. I don't know that I want all people to listen to me. I mean,
you're on the radio.
Well, I do agree. I draw a circle around my like intellectual moral community, and there are people in it. And it's an inclusive community. And within that circle, I think, well, our disagreements are reasonable disagreements. But somebody else might draw the circle of the people with whom they regard their disagreements as reasonable disagreement. They might draw that circle differently. You seem to believe that circle encompasses all humanity. But why should I believe that? I don't know why that's true. I don't know why there aren't kind of differently sized circles centered on different kind of points of view. Like, you know, Rawls has this notion of an overlapping consensus, but not all substantive modes of life or comprehensive views can go together in an overlapping consensus.
Yes, I don't think it extends to all humanity, but it extends very wide. So it's basically anybody who accepts the basic idea I said, that all of us are not just objects to be manipulated, but we're people who have thoughts and reasons behind them. And once you've got that going, once you accept that all people are like that, then you're already committed to the background sort of respect I'm pointing at. You might not always practice it, you might screw up, you might fail to remember it, but you do accept the basic thing. You do have that much in common. And so not everybody does. There are plenty of people out there in the world who have all sorts of views about people they refuse to engage with as humans, and those people are not in our circle. But the circle is actually very large, and so I don't think we should be looking for additional barriers to add to that. If we can find that common point of agreement, we're all people, we all have beliefs, we all have minds, and we're not just things to be manipulated. Once we've got that starting point going, I think that gives us actually a lot.
So Gina, I'm thinking there's this third alternative between people are objects to be manipulated and people are like people we have to listen to. And that's that we can leave each other alone. And I think like for a lot of interactions, say with my neighbors, a lot of the time I don't want to go talk to them about like my opinions about what they should be growing in their garden. Nor do I want to manipulate them particularly. I just want to live alongside them and not interact much. Isn't that an option? Like, when is and when isn't that an option?
Yeah, that's my question, too.
No, it's a really good question. So, for example, if I were to say it'd be great if the Toronto Raptors were to win. I don't know if your listeners know York University's in Toronto, so I'm going to go ahead and say that. And I imagine maybe some of your listeners might disagree with that. That's something where it might be good if we were to agree to disagree and not try to hash out our disagreements about who should be winning basketball tournaments. But other kinds of questions aren't like that. And I think moral questions are particular because most moral questions are what philosophers call universally prescriptive. They're claims about what everybody should do. And they give rise to a whole bunch of second-tier universally prescriptive claims, like when it's okay to shout at somebody, when it's okay to imprison them, when it's okay to hate them. And so given that the things we're disagreeing about in the moral domain are things that are meant to apply to everybody and not just basketball fans in a particular city, that's where it really matters, that we don't just avoid each other and avoid talking about these things.
Well,
because we all are implicitly making claims about what everybody has to do.
Well, maybe that's the mistake right there, to think that view of, I mean, maybe morality in some people's mouths purports to be universally prescriptive. But let's think about the political domain and whether politics and political procedures can settle the moral truth. And I think, suppose I'm the kind of philosopher, political philosopher, who think, well, settling the moral truth is not the business of politics. People are going to have their competing moral doctrines. Politics is not about, well, that's the true one and that's the other one. But politics is about how can we have a reasonable scheme of cooperation despite our moral differences without having to settle which is the true comprehensive moral doctrine. I'm kind of speaking in a kind of quasi-Rawlsian voice, and I just wonder what you think about that I mean, I'm not a Rawlsian for lots of reasons, but I'm kind of speaking in a quasi-Rawlsian voice just to try and figure out what you think about that kind of approach.
Yeah, so one of the distinctive things about Rawls is that he admitted he was generally doing what people call ideal theory, which is, in an idealized world, what would the ideal political system look like? And I'm not so sure that that is the ideal view, but even if it is, the real world isn't really like that. People aren't willing to, they don't approach politics as divorced from personal morality. Their political, their votes and who they support is informed by what they believe is right for all of us together. So I just don't think we can reasonably expect people to treat their political decision-making as separate from their moral beliefs. And given that, then again, a lot of our political action is about making universally prescriptive claims, how we should all be, how we should live together.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about tolerance and radical disagreement. And Rick from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Rick. What's your comment or question?
Yes, I have a comment regarding your co-host who said that people who are anti-vaxxers are unreasonable. I regard myself as a vaccine skeptic. So I'm very critical about the value of vaccines, but I do accept that some vaccines may be good. But I think his point of view is very unscientific. I think you ought to be more open-minded about, and I consider myself a progressive. I'm not a closed-minded person. So how does he conclude that people who have skepticism about vaccines are somehow, closed-minded, unscientific? That just doesn't hold water.
Thanks for the comment, Rick. I think calls for a response from Ray. What do you think, Ray?
So there's a lot of evidence that vaccines have helped to prevent a lot of terrible diseases like polio. Like, polio is basically eradicated in this country because of vaccines. And there's not a lot of evidence that vaccines do things like cause autism. Like, there's a bunch of discredited research by some guy named Andrew Wakefield saying that they do. But, like, abstracting a little bit from the issue of vaccines, this is interesting. So one of the reasons I think that this is important is because it's a disagreement with consequences. So, like, if you get this wrong, if I get this wrong, then vaccines are doing like lots of terrible things to kids that I don't think they are. If you get this wrong, then vaccines are sort of preventing us from getting preventable diseases like mumps and polio. And if we don't like vaccinate our kids, then the social consequences for other people are going to be terrible. And I think this sort of brings us back to Regina's point about sort of morality being prescriptive for everybody. So I think that vaccinating children is a moral issue because I think if you don't do it, you could hurt other people and you kind of can't cordon the consequences of your actions off from other people.
So Gina, I want to know what you think about this debate between Ray and Rick. I mean, I think Ray's made a powerful point. I just want to know if there are real-world consequences that we have to live with. It's not just a matter of private preference and private action. Mm-hmm. Then, that's I think, Ray, your point is that puts pressure on us to, settle this issue in a way that we can all live with. Would you agree with that or not?
Yeah. What's interesting here is there's two different disagreements going on. One's a scientific disagreement about what the evidence shows, and the other is a moral disagreement of what you should do in a society if you disagree with other people about the science. And that's like a general argument that couldn't be about, it might not be about vaccines, it might be about climate change or other things. And so I take it that the scientific debate is not the kind of thing I'm talking about. Science is a different topic area, it's not morality. And I take it that our standards there need to be about scientific debate. And so that's where I think I'm with Ray as far as the science goes. What's more complicated, and I think your caller is getting at, is if you find yourself just unconvinced by the science and everybody's telling you you're wrong and you have to make decisions about your own kids and your own life, and that's a moral question. And I think there's an argument to be made that given our responsibilities to other people, we ought to take the chance from our own perspective of getting the science wrong and act in a way that's meant to protect other people. Right. And that even if you don't end up agreeing with the science, that might be the right answer. So but I think that's debatable.
So even if I don't want to push this Rawlsian line too hard. But if I were a Rawlsian, I would say, well, look, it's a moral disagreement, but But the moral disagreement, we're not going to settle that through politics. What we have to do is settle our political disagreement, and we have to do that by appealing to a special kind of reason, what he calls a public reason, that, you know, may and may not look like a good reason from your, like, comprehensive moral point of view, but we're not arguing from our comprehensive moral point of view. Ray, you want to get in here?
Something just occurred to me about this debate in particular, and also about climate debates, which is that they're factual, so they have moral consequences. Right. But they're factual, and they ought to be able to be settled by sort of public shared factual means. And it's interesting that these debates continue, even though, you know, you'd think that, like, if everybody looks at the factual evidence, we should all be able to come to some agreement or other.
Well, there's values, too. But Gina, what do you think?
There's something tricky going on there. So I'm not a climate scientist. I'm not a vaccine scientist. I don't think either of you are either. And I don't think any of us have sincerely weighed up the evidence on these things. Instead, we're relying on trust of a particular scientific community. And we're relying on a value judgment about who to trust and why to trust them and when to trust them. And those values are really complicated. I'm not sure they're moral. They're not scientific at first pass. There's something really complicatedly social. And that's where I think we can have an honest disagreement about how to approach when to trust experts. Now, my own view is these are pretty clear cases where we should trust the climate change experts and the vaccine experts. But I want to allow space for having an open discussion with people who don't accept that claim about who to trust. And that's where it's not a scientific question. It's a question about how we arrange society together.
So we got another caller on the line. Aria from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Aria.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I think one element that's being left out of this incredibly important and practical discussion is that people have a lot of fear, and they're identified with their beliefs and the experiences, if I'm not right, I'm nothing. So we have to go through that experience together, sort of confusion and disorientation together, when we're willing to be willing to experience that confusion together, but also to be impacted by other people's ideas that we don't necessarily agree with, and we will be changed in some important way, even if our basic viewpoint is based on science or pseudoscience or strong convictions that have been handed down to us. So we have to really know that that's the cost of being together with diverse people, and in the future it will be based on consensus.
Aria, you're raising a really important and really deep question. I wish we got to take to a break, but I want to make a really quick point about what Aria says. This is why I'm not a Rawlsian, because of something that Aria said. Because if I were a deeply religious person, I would say that Rawls is demanding that I check my identity, my fundamental identity, at the door before I enter into public debate, and that the things that strike me as, like, the deepest possible reasons can't be put forth as a reason. But that seems like really wrong.
Ken, I want to hear what Gina has to say about this.
Yeah. Maybe I'm
with Ken on that.
You're with me on that?
I'm with you on that.
Okay. So, but we can take this up a little more after the break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about radical disagreement with Regina Rini from York University.
How can we prevent moral disagreements from degenerating into shouting matches or civil wars? What's the best way to cultivate respectful conversations in the social media age?
Fake news, flame wars, and your civic duties. When Philosophy Talk continues. You go your way and I go mine. That's the best we can do when we disagree. I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and our guest is Regina Rini from York University. And we're asking, how do we cultivate respectful disagreement?
So I want to go back to just what we said before the break, because you said you were with me. But I want you to expand on this point. Somebody has a point of view that's deeply tied up with who they are. And like I said, the reason I'm not a Rawlsian is because it seems to me that the Rawlsian requires that those kinds of points of view, those kinds of reasons that are generated from that point of view, don't get to enter at least the political sphere. And that seems to me people aren't like that. And you said you were with me, but I'd like you to expand on that if possible.
Yeah. No, I think I basically agree with what you said so far, though I'd add one thing. So I think it's unreasonable to expect people to set aside their fundamental identities in the political realm. That's just not how people work. The one thing I want to insist on goes back to something I said earlier, the kind of people we don't have to listen to, which are the ones who take as an assumption that certain types of people don't count, that they're not fully human, they don't get basic civil rights, and they don't get to be part of the political discourse. And the reason why that's special is because we can't actually have democratic discourse if we're taking it that some people who are trying to speak don't get heard, don't get to have any voice at all. In order to be able to work together and form some sort of common will, a choice together as a democratic society, we have to take that as our starting point that everybody counts. And so I take it that people who come in with the starting point that some people don't get to count, that position they're holding should be rejected by the rest of us as the ground rules.
So Gina, that seems right, but I'm wondering how you tell when something constitutes that kind of disrespect and when something is just disagreement. It's sort of not always obvious.
Absolutely. I think that's the hardest, and most important question here, because it's very, very tempting to say the people I disagree with, that's what they're doing. In a complicated way, they're just ignoring the basic human equality of some people. And the problem is that sometimes that's true, and sometimes we're just telling ourselves that as an excuse to disagree with them. And I actually think philosophers are not the best situated to figure this out. Often psychologists are in a better position, or even, I was thinking about this, like professional poker players, the people who can tell whether somebody's sincere from the way they're speaking and the way their face looks, may actually be better at this than we are. Yeah. So I wish I had an answer, and I find this so vexing. But
Gina, I want to try something else out on you, though, because you said something. I don't know if you noticed the conditional, but you said a conditional, something about if we're committed to democracy. I agree, if we're committed to democracy. And the more inclusive and pluralistic our we will allow our democracy to be. But, you know, democracy is really, really hard. It's cacophonous and all this sort of stuff. And I say, well, if you can get kind of begrudging tolerance among a wide range of people, hey, you've won some kind of victory. But you know what? Democratic societies often fracture precisely because people cannot sustain this thing. And so you could say, well, one person's ponens is another person's tollens. That is, so maybe instead of democracy, we should narrow the scope of political community to something like populism, or maybe vanguard movements, which say, I have to divide the people into like the revolutionary people who need to be transformed and the anti-revolutionary reaction elements. I don't listen to the capitalists anymore. You were bargaining with the capitalists over like trade unionists. What you want to do is seize the factory. History is full of that stuff. So tell me how to think about that, because there's populist movements, there's vanguardist movements, there's revolutionary overthrow of the old order, which is precisely the opposite of let's listen and tolerate.
Yeah, no. I think we're hitting a kind of bedrock here, which is that my commitment to democracy, and I think a lot of explicit Democrats, small d Democrats, comes from the idea that democracy is really fundamental to who we are. It's the political system that instantiates the idea that we're all equal and that we all regard each other as equals. And a lot of the extreme movements you're talking about start from the assumption that we're not, that there is some privileged group that knows the right way and is going to lead us all to the right way of having things. And if everybody doesn't come along, then we'll take whatever means are necessary to make them come along. And I can't exactly give an argument against that position. It's just that I find it repellent, and I think a lot of us do, and those of us who do find that as a starting point repellent are thereby Democrats. We're united in this conception that what we need is a society where everybody counts in our decision making.
I totally agree with you, and I think, but I guess all I want to add is it's really hard, and it's really hard to achieve and sustain, partly because of the way people are about these things. But we've got a caller, Phil from Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Phil. What's your comment or question?
Hey, well, I just wanted to thank you guys for the whole discussion in general, and then raise this question about attention, potentially, that's here. One of the things we talk about is, why do these conversations break down into shouting? And one of the callers mentioned, well, that one of the things we need to mention is the fear, and that people identify with the position they have, and they feel personally threatened when they're challenged on that idea. And some people therefore go into conversations refusing to ever budge from that position, so then it's not a conversation. So we could sort of say that the ego, or like identifying with a position, is the problem. And so my question to you guys, because we then were just talking about how, well, it's impossible to leave my identity at the door. So how can we, you know, not leave our identity at the door, but also take our ego out of the conversation?
I think that's a question for you, Gina, since you're the expert here. Thanks, Phil.
It's a really good question. It's also really hard. And I think what your caller's identifying is something about vulnerability. If I go into this discussion with somebody who deeply disagrees with me and make myself open to being persuaded, I'm making something about me, something fundamental about me, up for grabs. That's really hard. And there's all this psychological pressure to never, ever do that because we don't want to be vulnerable in that way. And I think what that tells us is that if we want to have these honest conversations, they're not going to happen like in the middle of a political rally on a debate stage. They're going to happen one-to-one in quiet places where there's not an audience shouting and where people feel that the background conditions are enough to make them safe to be vulnerable. And that's really hard to create that situation. But when we can, that's really useful to have it.
So you mentioned creating the right background conditions for a good conversation. And a lot of political discussion these days takes place on sort of social media and the internet, which seems like it might create questionable background conditions for a conversation. Mm-hmm. Do you have thoughts about how we can do better or what kinds of problems social media might cause?
Yeah, absolutely. So the number one problem is the audience problem. Everybody on social media imagines themselves up on a debate stage with a microphone, and they imagine there are thousands of people out there watching, and everything they say is being judged as a move in a competitive debate. I mean, when people are sharing pictures of their cats, but when people are arguing about politics, they think about it this way. And that puts us in exactly the wrong position, because now, if you listen to the other side and concede anything, then you're admitting a vulnerability and you're weakening your position. And I think this is really fundamental to how social media works, the social part of social media. So I'm actually really worried that we're not capable of having, most of us, most of the time, are not capable of having really genuinely open and good conversations on social media. Some people find ways to do it, but I actually don't understand how they do reliably.
Yeah, they're few and far between. But look, I think we're at something really deep that's prompted by our caller and the talk about vulnerability and all that. Look, I think one of the things that's difficult in a democracy is, as like ours, is this what I call the civic square, right? Mm-hmm. Not the governmental. We know what the government should and shouldn't do. We have pretty good theories of that. But how citizens should relate to one another in their daily commerce, not mediated by government, but in citizen to citizen engagement in the public square. I think we have a completely broken public square. Completely, utterly broken, and we don't know how to gauge each other as free and equal citizens on non-government mediated exchanges. And I don't know how to fix that, but I think we do need to fix that if democracy is going to survive. What do you think about that thought?
Yeah, that seems right to me. I don't know if I think it's quite as broken as you. You said completely broken. I don't know if we're that far gone yet, although I agree that things have gotten pretty bad. And I do blame social media for playing a role in getting us to that point. I'm actually working on a book right now that's about social media and democracy, and I am really scared that it might just be that social media is not compatible with maintaining a good democratic culture. It might be that we all have to just agree to give it up if we're going to have a chance at keeping a decent culture going.
Well, it's not just social media.
I know the problems also.
Fox News, MSNBC,
yeah.
All this hyper-partisanship, campaigns. You talked about you're not just a person to be manipulated. Well, most of our political class thinks of the voters as not people to be informed and engaged in democratic deliberation, but in manipulation, and the arts of manipulation are honed to a fairly well. I mean, I do think it's a crisis.
And that's why people hate politicians, because that is, to be an effective politician, you have to think about human beings in that way, and that we don't want to be thought about in that way. So it's really scary that a lot of us are now acting like little politicians all the time and thinking about everybody else in that way. How can we maximize partisan advantage for our own side? And I wish I had the solution. That's the scary part here. I feel like I have a diagnosis on a lot of what's happening, but I don't know how we solve it. So I think I'm with you in saying we're in a difficult situation, and I hope smarter people are thinking about ways of pulling us back.
They're not smarter. They may have different techniques.
Ken, you got to respect people and trust people. That's what we talked about the whole time.
So, Gene, I want to give you one last thought. You said you don't have a solution, right? But I want to give you—I want you to give us a takeaway for this conversation, because I think this is deep, hard, challenging stuff at the core of democratic life. So, give us one last takeaway.
So what I think is helpful is if you ever find yourself in a position where you're talking to somebody you know you disagree with deeply, but you have a kind of relationship, maybe they're a close family member, close friend, someone you really deeply trust, and you can put yourself in a moment of vulnerability and just say to them, you know what, I'd like to honestly hear why you think that thing I don't agree with, and I'm going to listen to you and give you a fair hearing. I might not agree with you, but I'm going to do it. And they can trust you to mean it when you say that. Take advantage of that, because like that's uncomfortable. People don't want to do that. It feels corny at best or dangerous at worst, but those are so rare. If you can find that, that's a really good thing to experience, and hopefully you can come away from that experience finding chances for it elsewhere.
On that hopeful note, I'm going to thank you for joining us, Gina. This has been a very agreeable conversation.
I agree.
Our guest has been Regina Rini, professor of philosophy from York University, author of Abortion, Ultrasound, and Moral Persuasion, among other things. So, Ray, are you having agreeable or disagreeable thoughts now?
I'm having agreeable thoughts, but I'm a little pessimistic. I'm hoping that we can all sort of achieve the ideals that Gina really seems to want. And I just think we have to have the trust in each other to do it somehow.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I'm more than a little pessimistic. I'm a lot pessimistic. But what I do believe is that humans are what they are, but we have to design a social world which compensates for what humans are. And so we need to design the public square completely differently. Social media, as it's evolved, is an abomination. The news media, as it evolved, is an abomination. Our political campaigns are an abomination. So we got to start over. But you know what? This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, with apologies to Descartes, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in our community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog. Now, here's a guy who only tolerates his philosophy at high speed. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, things are getting better for tolerance these days, I think. Certainly consciousness is being raised to unheard of heights. New communities are springing up every day. The transgender community, the Cambodian immigrant community. We're community building. We're diverse and woke. We got best-selling self-help books on the shelves targeting special needs. We just found out about how to be gluten-free, how to infest our gut with good bacteria. We got TED Talks and swarms of advisors, counselors, psychologists invading our talk shows and informing us how to navigate the treacherous waters of intolerance. The fly in this ointment is that tolerance is not a two-way street. Racists are supposed to tolerate people of color, but people of color are not allowed to tolerate racists, even though they are an endangered minority, I hope. We can't tolerate sexism, but the Me Too movement and identity politics have led to all sorts of sometimes troubling new elements to our moral tinkering. The emergence of toxic masculinity, for instance, the nuances of inappropriate touching, leading to the death of the group hug, the toppling of Confederate statues, the removal of elephants from the circus, trigger warnings, interrogating our cultural assumptions, walking back, moving forward, calling out, coming out, and self-identifying as a shamer of fat shamers. Of course, there's a backlash. People who have deep concerns, allegedly, around accusations of white privilege, calls for reparations of slavery, the spread of the cultures of victimhood, all those communities, each with its own agenda, are just going to bring us all crashing down into the rising sea of global warming, which is just a lie, but progressives are going to make it happen anyway. Just to get Trump. It's sad. It's a sad conspiracy attempted coup. Let me interrogate the larger picture here. What we have here is a weird master culture constantly striving to be monolithic. It used to be just white, not only just white, but German, French, English. Then came the Irish, Greeks, Italians, Jews, Chinese, Japanese, many of whom were kept on the outside of the monolith, forcing themselves to form their own subcultures, the mafia, vaudeville performers, binge drinkers, corrupt politicians. When Indians got in the way, we killed them, saving a few back to be buddies later on and to own casinos. Black people, well, they're just now entering the monolith, and a sizable minority of the majority is still peeved about it. But, not to put too fine a point on it, it's not white so much that's being promoted, but a corpus of behaviors. Anybody can belong, but you gotta act the part. More suburban than anything else. Live in a house rather than an apartment, you're in. You can play basketball on your driveway, but no ethnic dances. You can scream at sporting events, but not out your window at 3 a.m. You can be gay if you get married and have kids. Now you can have tattoos and still get a job, as long as it's not a naked woman embracing a cobra and it's not on your face. Take the Uber, not the bus. Protest march, but don't pick fights with the neo-Nazis. Use GoFundMe, not government grants. Tolerance, my friends. There's a theoretical level playing field that we have to aspire to if you want to belong. Kind of like a really boring heaven, and everybody's treated the same. Somewhere above that field, a point of view hovers, deciding what's not being allowed in the field and what is. It is decided, but it's not always clear how. It's arrived at by a weird consensus that is both conscious and unconscious, democratic and mob-driven, hysterical and stuck in the mud, ever-changing and as old as original sin. But tolerance is a weird way to look at it. I mean, we have a tolerance for pain, tolerance for fools, a tolerance for alcohol. The assistant principal had a low tolerance for my schoolyard shenanigans, and I don't know how much longer I can tolerate the tweets of Trump, though what choice do I have, really? Tolerance levels, in other words, are always different, not always positive. Tolerance is what we go through until we just can't take it anymore, and it becomes intolerable. The approval ratings get so low, it's canceled, unless it gains a cult following. That's my dream, my hope. But then again, I identify as pugnacious, the cranky, incipient geezer with bum leg community, population one, that's me. I am definitely endangered. Won't you please help? Tolerate me, if you can. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2019.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pementoine.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Shut your festering gob, you tit! Your type makes me puke! You vacuous, toffee-nosed, malodorous pervert!
Look! I came in here for an argument!
Oh, I'm sorry. This is abuse.